Shrink Wrap Radio number 860. Alan Sussman, MD, discussing his book, Saving the Art of Medicine.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Alan Sussman, MD, author of the new book, Saving the Art of Medicine, in which he argues that medicine should be more than just the treatment of a diseased or broken body part. Rather, physicians must respect the complex interrelationships of mind, body, and spirit, seeking always to connect the part to the whole. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Alan Sussman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, David, for having me. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah, me too. And really glad to have you here. And we're going to be discussing your book, The Art of Medicine. And that's such an intriguing title. So I can't wait to jump into it a bit.
Great. Yes. No, I think there's a lot of saving that needs to happen.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, saving the art. It's saving the art of medicine. I've got the title wrong. The complete title is Saving the Art of Medicine. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. No, in fact, also the subtitle, Observations of a Practitioner, has some meaning to it too. Double meaning.
Yes. Okay, so it seems like you had a bit of a wake-up call in terms of a more humanistic or holistic approach to medicine than you started with?
Yes, absolutely. I when I was growing up, I was probably be called a nerd.
Me too.
I was very, very academic, had very high IQ in terms of mathematics and science. And I thought all the answers to life was in science and math.
Yeah, I can understand that. Now, we're going to be discussing a major change that partly will explain that in a bit. But I'm wondering, what was the catalyst? I'm wondering if there was anything, say, in your childhood or your disposition, despite the way you described yourself, that might have foreshadowed this potential humanistic leaning.
Well, there was the humanistic part gradually grew, but there was a general change in my thought processes about what life was all about and that science was not the whole answer. It goes all the way back to high school where I ended up on a yin-yang situation of, on one hand, I was very Freudian and was reading everything that Freud had ever written.
Yeah.
So all the answers were there.
Wow.
And then I got very involved in D.H. Lawrence. And the interesting thing is that D.H. Lawrence wrote a book about Freud, where he was very vindictive about Freud. And Freud was in the mind. Yeah, and D.H. Lawrence was in the gut.
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. I did not know that bit of Freudian history. That's fascinating. And so what you read in D.H. Lawrence moved you away from the idea that that Freud had understood everything about life.
Right, right. Or that there was another part to life. The other part of life is more internal, cannot necessarily be expressed in words, but is more in a whole sense of one's being. And so that there was the beginning of that inkling there.
Interesting.
It didn't switch.
Yeah, I had a sense that something maybe had started earlier in your life to foreshadow this. And we're just lucky you didn't go off and join the French Foreign Legion.
Yeah, I could have done that. Oh, no, no. I also went in other directions, too. I got involved in a lot of ESP work, too, in college.
Uh-huh. PTSD, did you say?
ESP, extrasensory perception.
Oh, ESP, yes. I also, that's been... was an interest of mine for some time, and it hasn't totally gone away, I must say. So I'm not sure if the of our age difference, but psychology and even large parts of our culture made a shift in that direction, I would say, in the 60s and 70s.
That's me.
Yeah, that's you too.
Yes.
Yeah, that had a big impact on me, and I think on a whole subculture, you know, due to the advent of a combination of factors, you know, the Vietnam War and the rebellion against the war, the collapse of the trust of authority and institutions, the sense that maybe we could reinvent ourselves, the advent of psychedelics, all of those things made this this wonderful witch's brew, if you will.
Yes, or as I like to say, is it confused things.
Yeah. So in your book, you hearken back to earlier times when physicians spent more time with their patients and listened more deeply. Take us through that a bit.
Okay. Well, if we go all the way back, we say, what was medicine at the beginning?
Yeah.
Medicine probably came from shamanism. And in shamanism, you had...
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I've said that on my show many times, not about medicine as much as about psychology in general. And certainly clinical psychology, quotes the healing arts. But go ahead.
Yes. So anyway, it's a very, as you know, it's a very strong ritualistic practice in which there is a very strong bonding between the practitioner and the patient.
Right.
And a belief system that's very closely aligned or becomes aligned during that process. And my belief is that is therapeutic.
I agree.
and it was also at a very intense level, which is hard to replicate in modern era, but can at least be considered as an element in good healthcare.
Yeah. And so then moving it forward in time, what happened?
Well, when you look at the Greek times, and you talk about Hippocrates, and there was still the Hippocratic oath that we have. Hippocrates said that he's more interested in knowing who the patient is of the disease than the disease itself. It was a time of true observation.
Yeah.
In terms of treatment and diagnosis at that time, because if you look at the underlying reasoning that was used for why diseases happened, they didn't get it right. But that doesn't mean that they couldn't achieve a lot through that. And so it wasn't until you got to the the Renaissance, you now had looking more at the body. It wasn't until almost the 15th, 16th century that you started even looking at the body of human beings. You were only looking at animals beforehand. You couldn't look at human cadavers. So eventually you started approaching what was going on with the human being rather than a more fanciful way of looking at it. And then, of course, it's the 19th century that everything really broke through, at which time modern science really came to bear. And we started particularizing. And this is the big point that I like to make in my book is that science is wonderful. We wouldn't be talking right now without it.
Yeah.
But science is very particular in what it does. So it's doing very little chunks of what it's trying to say. And then we have to interpret it. And that has an importance, but what I feel right now, it's become overly important.
Yeah, the chunks have gotten smaller and smaller in terms of specialization, and you know, and all the papers that are written that are so specialized that they represent just like a little tiny sliver of everything that's going on, and the ability to synthesize it and get a bigger picture is really, I think, very challenging. And part of what you go into is the advent of new tools that have also transformed our understanding of medicine and made it, put it more in that scientific cast.
Oh, well, if you're referring to you know, CAT scans, MRIs, a lot of technical advances that have been fantastic in terms of being able to see the body, that's very important. And again, that's, we're now entering a new age here, which is going to now be the age of the large language model AIs. That's going to transform things again. And at some point, if you want, we can talk about how that's going to be good and bad.
Yeah. I'm very interested in that topic as well. So I look forward to that. So talk about the science of medicine versus the art of a bit more, because your book is really about the art of medicine.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the science in medicine can be equated with evidence-based medicine. And that terminology was actually not coined until the end of the 20th century. And so it's been a relatively short period of time that has taken over.
Yeah.
And what evidence-based medicine says is, we got these little different chunks that we're doing in a very specific manner. And the most specific manner in which that done is called randomized controlled trials, which I'm sure you're well familiar with. But it's a very limited, but what it says is very limited. It virtually only applies to the study itself because it's so rigorous. And then what you have is you have interpretation of that. And you go then from what's the objective to the subjective. And what I maintain is that no matter how objective you think evidence-based medicine is, in practice, there's a lot of subjectivity with it. And if we accept that, we then maybe are more open to the idea that we should also be considering our own subjectivity and humanity as an important part of the healing process, which, as we talked before, was throughout history, was very important, but it's becoming less and less important. If you're considered a good doctor, sometimes you're purely considered a good doctor because you follow all the guidelines.
In terms of the insurance companies and all, that's
the insurance companies, and it becomes a societal issue too.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and then you have these mega institutions that are based on the idea of promoting evidence-based medicine, not only through pharmacology institutions and pharmaceuticals, but you have areas like the NIH, which is a magnificent body, and I don't want to deprecate it at all, but its whole modus operandi is to try to clear the air of what's evidence-based medicine and what is the most valuable uses of it.
Yeah, the evidence-based is certainly has become a big topic in psychology as well, in clinical psychology, which is my training background in particular. But there are pluses and minuses to that, right? What are the limitations of evidence-based? It sounds good on paper.
But exactly. On paper, it's great. And there have been a lot of papers written.
Yeah.
I think it's a question of understanding what information you're getting. And part of the problem that happens is not just even the study itself, but the media presentation of it.
Mm-hmm.
The media gets hold of it and can basically change a point of view in healthcare on an extraordinary level. Like one of the big areas that a lot of people are familiar with, particularly women, is from the Women's Health Initiative and estrogen use. Estrogens. Female
estrogen,
hormones.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Female hormones.
And
it's enough to drive anyone crazy and drove a lot of women crazy. You know, should I be taking them or shouldn't I? There was decades that all the evidence-based medicine was building up saying, yes, take estrogens. Everyone should take, all women should take it. Part of it goes back to the observation from the Framingham study that women had less cardiovascular disease than men. But then when women got to menopause, it started equalizing and saying, what's the difference? Well, probably hormones, estrogens. So then there was a big study that was done in the Women's Health Initiative looking at that very problem. And they were expecting to find that estrogens would be protective against cardiovascular disease. And the results of this very long study that was going on 7 years was, no, it isn't. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It said both. And when you started parsing it apart, you can actually say there is benefits from it. But the media immediately glommed onto the idea that estrogens are not what they were thought to be, and were not nuancing what was being said, and it threw out the whole idea of using estrogens at that time.
Uh-huh, good example. And it also brings to mind that another sort of major limitation that we're coming to understand is that a lot of these, the tests, the double-blind studies and so on, they only go up to a certain age. I'm in an age that's beyond the age that they go up to. So it turns out that everything that gets prescribed to me that I need to do and take, et cetera, has not been tested in a rigorous way in my age group.
Yes, well, yeah, right. You can talk about age group. You can talk about ethnic backgrounds.
Yeah.
To talk about the point a little further, I don't know if you're familiar with WEIRD.
It rings a bell. WEIRD?
Yes. Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic.
Yeah, there you go.
That represents the majority of the people who have participated in evidence-based trials.
Right. And we're just starting to be aware. The people who are outside that are calling our attention to the fact that, hey, this isn't based on us.
Yes. Yes. And you see, when I get into nuancing it further is, even when it looks like it's appropriate for that person in terms of saying, oh, I fit into that age group, my white male, and it's a white male sort of study. There are so many other factors that can be involved that aren't looked at, that it could still not be important or the most important way for that individual to look at it. I would agree for a population, it would be, but eventually it's a doctor and a patient and they have to make a decision. And the studies are not actually talking about that individual. They're talking about a population. And you have to decide how to stir that into the whole pot.
Right, right. Yeah. So we should probably mention at this point, that's this late in the game, that actually your field for most of your professional life has been that you're a board-certified endocrinologist for 34 years, and right. You were more of an academic practitioner, and then somehow you switched. Talk to us about what shifted you then into becoming a more generalized medical practitioner.
Right. Well, it was a major change in my life, which was traumatic, physically traumatic, where I fell off a roof, the details of which I won't give you. It's horrified people when they've heard it. So
yeah,
but I grabbed onto the corrugated eave when I was falling off. It was only one story, but I cut 8 tendons in my hand. Ooh. And suddenly the things that I used to do to balance my life out at that point, which was tennis and playing piano.
Yeah.
Gone. Actually my hand never completely recovered. Eventually my shoulder wasn't good because of it. So physically I changed, and someone had brought up the idea of a men's group to join that they had asked before if I was interested in, and I did. And they were supposedly going to do meditation. It was a book by Robert Bly.
Sure.
And they weren't really meditating, but there was meditations in there. So I decided I was going to learn how to meditate. And that really changed my whole perspective on life at that point.
Wow.
And at the meantime, that was a major shift in what became important in my life, but also the humanistic part became just a question of keep on practicing with patients. I just enjoyed practice. I enjoyed being with patients. I developed a lot of close relationships with patients, and I realized how important my interaction was with them, to the point there were times where I would be with a patient and we would spend 15, 20 minutes. And at the end of it, I was saying, now, how in the world am I going to bill for this?
Right.
The patient left very satisfied, felt as though we really hadn't talked about things that were important to them in their life, but I had no idea what the right billing code was.
Unfortunately, you have to lie. You have to fudge it a bit, right?
Yes.
That's what happens.
Absolutely. I would come up with something, but I just knew it did not actually relate to exactly what happened and the importance of what happened.
Yeah, I relate to so much of what you've said, down to the level of I've been in a men's group for something like 32 years or 38 years, and one of the members of our men's group was a roofer and fell from the roof, and he's shorter now than he used to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, so,
yeah.
And we also, you know, went through meditation and the, and I have a background in humanistic psychology, and so I really can relate to everything that you're saying here. So let's talk more about the art of and you've already emphasized that you're not anti-science.
Exactly. I'm very pro-science.
Yeah, yeah, pro-science. So, as am I. I'm not anti-science either. but it requires, you know, talk about meditation. I mean, it's a fine balancing act, really, to hold multiple perspectives and multiple realities, multiple versions of reality, right?
That is... I could not have said that better. That's the important thing is to be able to hold all of it. And also to, when you're doing that, is to realize that every experience is actually a new experience. Mm-hmm. And there's something you can learn from it.
Yeah.
And it's like Sherlock Holmes said that every time he approached a new case, it was with an absolutely blank mind.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, to be able to really draw in all the possibilities of what's there. And if you're just looking at the evidence-based part of it, you don't have a blank mind.
Yeah, yeah. So in the course of this transformation, you've looked into a lot of alternative medicine approaches, and I think you have the impression that you found value in some, and
yes.
And others, either not so much or worse.
Oh well, as is true in all of medicine, right? I mean, there's you know, I think it's a part of the armamentarium that should be there, and the problem is it's not a very good area. Like herbal medicines, to look at it in terms of evidence-based medicine, where there is quite a bit of it, but if you're going to do it rigorously, it is very hard to prove it. Among other reasons is you have to use herbal preparations that are highly purified and regulated. And there's a whole page just to go through that when you're trying to put in a study on an herbal medicine to say that you've met all the standards there.
Uh-huh.
Well, the pharmaceutical industry has that beat, and they have the resources to really make sure that they're seen and that they can achieve that end. The one of the big examples that I use in herbal medicine that relates to my field of endocrinology was the use of strontium. And strontium, as many of you know, is a mineral, and it's a very common mineral. But it has benefits to the bone, where it can help bone development, incretion, as well as prevent the destruction of bone in a way that's probably better than the pharmaceutical agents that's out there on a theoretic basis, for sure. And strontium was never used very much because you say, where's the evidence for it? Well, to do evidence for it, you have to do a big study. To do a big study, you got to have a lot of money and
yeah.
time. And so the big studies were actually done in Europe, and they were excellent, and they were as good as the studies that were done by pharmaceutical agents with the usual agents, which are called bisphosphonates. And there were two excellent studies. And then in reviewing it, these studies a year later, they said, wait a minute, there looks as though there might have been an increased cardiovascular signal here, that there might be an increased risk of cardiovascular disease if you take it. Well, technically, that is just what's called a signal. It's not called proof, because the study was not looking at that. You look at randomized processes in terms of whether equal numbers of heart problems on both sides, et cetera, that wasn't being looked at in the study. But again, the media took this and said strontium can't be used because that caused heart disease. You can look at the pharmaceutical area and you will see the same type of problems that they had, but they were able to throw more resources at it. So the basic problem is resources. There aren't the resources to try to prove herbal medicines as much as there is for the pharmaceuticals that are present from the pharmacology institutions.
Yeah, so the point that that I think you're underscoring here is that the demands of the insurance companies and so on are so stringent that people can't afford to do the research that would, you know, quotes, prove the efficacy.
Right, exactly.
Of their approach.
Yeah.
Now, some of the things that I think you mentioned being favorably influenced by are EMD.
There were some herbal ones I had personal experience with.
Okay.
I was in. I'm a meditator, and I've done different. I've gone to different sanghas and meetings, including with the Dalai Lama in India.
Oh, wow.
I was in India in Dharamsala, and even before I got there, I was starting to feel sick. I'd had a lot of dental work done. And when I got there, every day I was having more and more difficult swallowing. And to the point where I was getting pretty concerned.
Yeah.
I have a history of oral herpes, not genital, oral. And I thought maybe that was it. And I was going to start an antiviral, but I said that would take days. And at that point, I'll be having a terrible time. Well, I went to the herbalist that is associated with the Tibetan government in exile in Dharamsala, who I had met. And she got me immediately in to see one of the local doctors in their clinic. And I was given a slew of herbal preparations. And virtually within 2 hours of putting on a salve on my neck, the pain went away. Within 6 or 7 hours, I was suddenly able to eat a meal and had more sense of energy. And I know that the medicine I was taking, antivirals, just shorten the course. They don't really help alleviate the symptoms at that point. So I became a believer there was something there.
Right, really. Yeah.
Personal experience.
Yeah. So who's the target for this book? Who's your target audience?
Yeah, well, what people have told me is that it should be anyone who's pre-med, interested in going into medicine or into healthcare, interns, residents, in order to get a real perspective on the whole medical field. But I think anyone who is really interested in trying to understand healthcare for themselves, their interaction with doctors, and how they can empower themselves in taking care of their health should have some benefit with it. The one thing with this book is it's not exhaustive. It's more hopping around to different areas.
Yeah.
And as I like to say, it's a kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of different areas, and you keep on turning the kaleidoscope to see a different image.
Yeah, I would say that makes sense to me. I got that feeling a bit. And, you know, one of the things that you talked about that caught my eye was you talk about rigor versus rigidity.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Say a bit about that.
Yeah, right. The rigor is, you look at evidence-based medicine, it is very rigorous, which means that it's very precise in the way it's put together. You have to have randomized people, and you have to determine how you're going to randomize them. And there's computer programs for that. Every visit has to be very well thought out of and determined. Gathering information is done in a very particular way. Everything is very rigorous, very much to a letter, what's going on. So that's good. That can lead to, unfortunately, to rigidity once the study is out there. You can say, here, we got this study. Now I know what this means. You're being rigid about it. You're saying, because you did that one study, that you've now understand the whole field or the concept with it, uh-huh. And you don't.
Uh-huh.
And as you know, science never tells you what's something true. It only tells you what something isn't.
Yeah, and it can only talk in terms of probabilities as well, right? So we can't,
yes.
We can't reach certainty.
Yes. And here I can give you my one parable that I've concocted or melanged together from different sources to try to discuss this point. And I call it the Ari Zen parable. And you have these two men walking down. I don't know why I used men, but anyway, two people walking down a path, not together. And there's two identical flowers on the side of the road. The first person to reach the two flowers is Ari. Ari is of Aristotelian logic. And he says, I am going to understand this flower. So what does he do? He picks the flower. He has amazing abilities of analytic material around and machines that he can look at it. He dices it. He puts it through spectroscopy. He puts it through enough tests to fill up a tome of books on different properties and things that's there. One thing that is evident at the end of it is you're no longer as a flower.
Right.
All right. Then Zen comes along and sees the other flower and he says, I'm going to understand the flower. So he sits down on the path and looks at the flower, and he starts feeling how the flower grew from a seed, how the seed was in an earth, and the moisture that was in the earth, the different nutrients that were present there, how they worked together so that the flower was gradually able to be formed, that eventually sprouted through the earth, then gets into the air and the sunlight, and how that interacts with it, and then how he is interacting with the flower, and how the sense of beauty that's there, the sense of nature that's present. And he spends hours there. And then he stands up, and he walks away and says, now I understand the flower. And the question is, who understands the flower better?
Oh, I love that Zen parable that you made up. It's a good one.
So I'm not saying that one is right or the other one's right, but I'm saying they both are needed.
Well, I think maybe with this parable, we will close off. I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. Any other point that you would like to make before we go?
Well, the only point is, because I'm asked this a lot, is, so what do you do with all this? How do you maneuver through the medical system, and how the medical system is, most people agree, is broken in many ways, and how do physicians survive in this era? And I think what it is, it's an internal process. And for me, the internal process and what's made it very, made it possible for me to go where I've gone and enjoy what I'm doing has to do with meditation. And I'm not saying that everyone has to meditate, but everyone has to have different parts of their life that are very important outside of their business life and what they're doing. And meditation for me was very important because it allowed me to be open and present. And that's the important thing. So I would like to just say, it's very important that someone be present with their patient and be open and have humility.
Wonderful. That's a wonderful wrap up. Dr. Alan Sussman, thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. Once again, I feel so privileged to meet my recent guest, Alan Sussman, MD. It was easy to establish good rapport with him because we share so many of the same values. Despite the fact that he lives in Seattle and me in the San Francisco Bay Area, we both ended the interview with the strong feeling that we would be good friends if we lived closer. The ostensible reason for our interview is his new book, Saving the Art of Medicine, Observations of a Practitioner, in which he argues that medicine should be more than just treatment of diseased or broken body parts. Rather, physicians must respect complex interrelationships of mind, body, and spirit, seeking always to connect the part to the whole. Clearly, for me as a humanistic psychologist, this book is in my wheelhouse. As so often happens, his sense of doctoring was transformed by a personal tragedy. He had been trained and steeped in traditional objective science, having been an academic board-certified endocrinologist for 34 years and clinical assistant professor at the University of Washington. He was involved in hundreds of evidence-based studies and the development of groundbreaking technology for the treatment of diabetes. He was not in clinical practice until destiny stepped in and he fell off a roof. The accident messed him up physically so badly that he could no longer use the laboratory tools that had been his bread and butter for so long. He went into a deep depression, which eventually led him to join a men's group and begin a meditation practice. As a result of meditation, he began to see reality through a much broader lens. Yes, science is a valuable tool that can reveal some of the answers, but it's not the whole story. He's moved into clinical practice that includes elements of alternative medicine, such as herbal treatments. I strongly recommend his book, Saving the Art of Medicine. It will be of particular value to physicians, medical students, nurses, and all of us who are distressed by the perfunctory way in which corporate medicine treats us today.
Dr. Dave is one of the most generous persons I know of. every Thursday I get spoiled with a new interview, which David has been working on all week, and for which he asks nothing in return but that we contemplate what his work is worth for us. So I did. And I realized I was hooked. A good measure of how much you value something is your reaction to your imagining it disappear. So I try to picture the day when shrink wrap radio doesn't exist anymore. And what I felt was sorrow, almost as if an old friend had passed away. So maybe you, like me, value the work of our dear old shrink more than you think. My response to that was a small donation. Was yours gonna be?
Thank you, Oscar, there in Stockholm. Thanks for your own generosity and for challenging others to follow your fine example. Once again, time to shrink wrap it up. Thanks to Alan Sussman, MD, author of The Art of Medicine, for his fine book and for taking us through highlights of his own remarkable journey. Next week, my guest will be Peter H. Kim, PhD, who has spent 2 decades building a body of scientific knowledge around the topic of trust, a field that had previously been largely undeveloped. We'll be discussing his book, How Trust Works, The Science of How Relationships Are Built, Broken, and Repaired. Until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves, others, and our precious Earth.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.